Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
It's almost like the fact that you can make a ton of money off this app is blinding people to all of these criminal offenses that the owner is being held to. So I think people need to start paying more attention to what's going on so that we can hold this man accountable.
If you look at what the hours of work could buy in the 70s and the 80s and what they can buy now, you realize labor, paid work, has just really been hammered, right? And all the wealth has been sluiced into the very top.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we have a double feature. Later on in the show, we'll be hearing from Charles U. Smith, author of the new book, The Hacker's Teleology, and proprietor of the Of Two Minds blog, which was named by CNBC as one of the top alternative financial websites just a few short years ago. He'll be speaking with us about a very interesting report by Jim Reed that was written for Deutsche Bank, which is the 17th largest bank in the entire world. In that report, Jim warns of a coming age of disorder that will disrupt and potentially reverse the processes of globalization that have reigned supreme the past few decades. But first up, in recent months, OnlyFans has become one of the most popular websites on the World Wide Web. Models have flocked to the website, selling their naughty pictures to consumers across the world. But what of OnlyFans' owner, who, it turns out, has been embroiled in a series of lawsuits and controversies in past years? Not only that, but now many OnlyFans users, as well as content creators, are saying that OnlyFans is ripping them off. Scott Stedman and Sophie Pierce of Forensic News, two journalists that are young and hungry, ambitious and ready to expose corruption, join me to discuss the swirl of controversies surrounding OnlyFans, or perhaps it's only scams. We shall see. So with that being said, let's get to the conversation with journalists Scott Stedman and Sophie Pierce of Forensic News. Welcome to Parallax Views, Scott Stedman and Sophie Pierce of Forensic News. We're going to be talking about an article the two of you wrote called OnlyFans Faces Allegations of Fraud and Theft. This sounds like a case of corruption, and I always enjoy talking about these sort of cases. But first, Scott, why don't you let my listeners know a little bit about Forensic News? I know we had you on before with Val Brockschmidt, but for my listeners that may not have heard that episode.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me, first of all. Forensic News is an independent news organization that I started over a year ago now, in May of 2019. And we're kind of a collection of younger people who are a little bit dissatisfied with how corporate media and mainstream media is reporting on matters of corruption and law and security. So we took it upon ourselves to start this new little independent news site. And since then, we've published almost 150 reports on kind of a range of things, banking information, like you mentioned with Val and Deutsche Bank, we're still on that trail, a lot of stuff about Russia. We followed the Mueller investigation, of course, and kind of those branches. And now we're kind of branching into a little bit more of social justice issues. And I would say this OnlyFans stuff kind of ties into that. It's still our kind of wheelhouse with corruption and money, following the money.
You guys are muckraking, essentially.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, that's kind of the goal here.
So, Sophie, since you're new to my listeners, maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself. You're at, Seattle University, and you're really interested in journalism, so I want to give you a chance to introduce yourself.
Yeah, thanks again for having me on this podcast. I'm a senior at Seattle University, so I haven't graduated yet, but I'm a journalism major. And for my investigative journalism class last year, I think winter quarter, I had to do a project where I interviewed an active investigative journalist in the field. And so I didn't know any. So I went on LinkedIn and I found Scott and I called him up for an interview. And then he was just like, "Hey, do you want to work for me? Do you want to write stories for me?" And I was like, "Absolutely." So this summer I was lucky enough to be able to write two stories for Forensic News, one on a possible replacement for first responders instead of police, and then also this OnlyFans article. So yeah, I'm kind of just starting my journey as a journalist, but I'm very lucky.
What got you interested in journalism, if I can ask, and then we'll move on to the article?
Yeah, definitely. I knew I wanted to be a journalist from sixth grade. I was like, I'm going to be a journalist because I wanted a job where I could travel anywhere in the world and I could report on anything that I wanted to, and I could get people's stories out that matter. Because I saw a lot of voices unheard in the world, and I thought that if I could travel into the places that, you know, without big corporate media kind of on my back telling me what I'm supposed to write, if I could do that in my own independent way, then I could get these stories out that desperately need to be heard. And that was kind of something that I fell in love with at a very young age.
So. That's awesome. I'm always glad to hear that. I think we need more independent journalism in America today. So that's awesome to hear. And
I think she gave a better pitch for Forensic News than I did. Definitely more eloquent. But yeah, who wouldn't want someone like that on the team? And especially doing it at a young age, it's super cool to have Sophie on the team.
So this article, OnlyFans faces allegations of fraud and theft. I guess we have to start with, I was telling someone yesterday that I was having lunch with about this interview that we were going to do about OnlyFans, and they immediately said, and this is going to sound crazy, but there's some folks out there that will say this, what's OnlyFans?
Right.
It's one of the most popular websites, but maybe, Scott, you can give a rundown for people that have been living under a rock for a while.
Yeah, so OnlyFans, that's super valid. Nobody knew what OnlyFans was a year ago, or maybe even 9 months ago. But it kind of took off. Essentially, it's a platform like Patreon where you pay for content. But especially since the lockdown, it's geared mostly towards sex work. And so I would say like 90 to 95% of what's on OnlyFans is sex work related. So like selling nudes for money, selling videos for money, homemade pornographic videos and the like. So basically, like I said, since the pandemic and the lockdown, sex workers can't, like, for example, they can't go to the strip club and work, a bunch of other, like, porn videos. You know, there's not, you know, you can't travel places. So a lot of that whole industry kind of shut down with the pandemic. And so people were looking for new ways to make money in the industry. And so they basically flocked to OnlyFans. And since the lockdown, it's really exploded in popularity to the point where I think right now it's the 200th most popular website in the entire United States.
It's making like what, between, I guess, April 2020, a researcher put the valuation of OnlyFans between 810 million and 936 million, right?
Totally. Yeah. And since the publication of that, it's only gotten way more popular. So this is no doubt like a billion-dollar plus company now. And, you know, normally we wouldn't, I don't want to say we wouldn't write an article like this, but the fact that it is such a huge company now definitely factored into why we think this is important and kind of the scale of what's going on.
Sophie, I don't know if you want to take the next question, but I was going to ask you, who's behind OnlyFans? And also maybe you can attest to the popularity of this, because I just graduated university last year, and I hear that it's really popular with a lot of kids on campus now, OnlyFans.
Mm-hmm. Well, Leonid Radvinsky is the owner of OnlyFans. He's the singular shareholder of the Fenix International Limited in London, which is basically OnlyFans. And so he is the one who would be pocketing most of the profits made off of OnlyFans. OnlyFans, so when a model posts or makes a video, the site takes 20% of their earnings. So he's making 20% of whatever the models are, you know, producing. Leonid Radvinsky is the Ukraine-American porn entrepreneur who is kind of behind all of these theft allegations. As far as attesting to its popularity, it's definitely very popular, especially amongst, like, I'm 20, so I have a lot of friends who are on OnlyFans and making money off of it. And I do know some people who subscribe to OnlyFans as well. I think the most popular way to advertise your OnlyFans is through social media, so it's a very new kind of way of getting your porn out there. You're using Twitter, you're using Instagram, you're using very public platforms, which is not something that we saw in the porn industry as much before, especially with young, you know, college students. So,
and I guess Radvinsky has a long history of allegations of spam, theft, fraud, and even drug dealing. Scott, maybe you could delve into that a little bit.
Yeah, so Radvinsky is kind of this guy who's in the world of online pornography. He's kind of infamous or famous. I don't know how you want to put it. He owns another site, which is called My Free Cams, which is similar to OnlyFans, but it's more like live streaming and camming instead of pictures and video, if that makes sense. But he's been in a number of lawsuits since the early 2000s. One of them was brought by Microsoft, where they claimed that he was using, or his companies were using like logos of Microsoft to try and spoof people into signing up for his company and for his services. So he would send like millions of emails, basically spamming people that said it came from Microsoft. Or another one was Amazon, where he used the Amazon logo. And so with My Free Cams, that's, you know, another popular venture of his, not nearly as to the scale of OnlyFans, but there's a lot of allegations with My Free Cams that we run through briefly, kind of the same sort of allegations where money gets stolen from people. He uses like these sketchy offshore bank accounts for his companies, and all the money doesn't get back to the model or content creator. And he has a lot of ventures like this, all in the online porn industry, and a lot of kind of sketchy allegations that we're trying to put together into one cohesive narrative of who this guy is.
And there's also concerns about, I guess, OnlyFans having, you know, potentially lax safeguards against possible child exploitation. Do you want to take that, Sophie?
Yeah, I would love to. This was the biggest part about why I wanted to write this article. It's because there's a whole sinister side. It's not just the money. There's actual humans being exploited in this process. And so OnlyFans advertises itself as an 18 plus site. And in its like privacy statement, it says that you have to be 18 plus and there will be identity checks. But I, as part of my investigative process, I created an account and I was able, under a false name and a false email, but I was able to post, create an account and post without a single 18 plus identification pop up. And so for me and for everybody else, that should be a major concern, not only for content creators, but for content consumers alike, because you want to know that who you're supporting is of age, right? And you want to know that who you're supporting is there because they want to be there and not because either somebody else is forcing them to be there, which is sex trafficking, which is the other side of sex work that we need to discuss. But also that this person has is legal under, you know, the law. So yeah, that was a big concern for the human interest aspect of this article. There was just a lack. And then also, sorry, but also OnlyFans allows screenshotting of content, which means that the content that models post is not even safe for themselves. So if a subscriber decides to subscribe to a model and then screenshot her content, his or her content, and then post it somewhere else on another account, that's possible. And there's no protection against that. So,
Scott, were you going to add something in that regard? Or
yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, it's different vein, but kind of similar. When Sophie was signing up for that account, like she said, she used a kind of a throwaway name and throwaway email. But after that process, she got an email from OnlyFans to her personal email. So that's kind of like one of the more bizarre aspects of this story is OnlyFans as a company somehow got Sophie's personal email that she didn't give them. And so there's a lot of concerns there about like data sharing and where did they get this data and, you know, like how, you know, how they were able to get a Gmail account from someone that signed up with a throwaway Proton. Like, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And not only that, the email contained somebody else's account and then a one-time access code to get into that account. And I'm assuming that they were using my Gmail for that account. So I could have used the code and then gotten into their account. So that's another security breach that...
And we've seen that, like, since we published this article, we've seen so many people complain on Twitter and to me and us via email that their accounts get hacked, because I'm assuming a lot of people are getting these emails with, like, access codes to other accounts that they don't control from OnlyFans. So it's another huge privacy concern, obviously, when people are able to store so much money in their accounts. And a lot of them have social security numbers and driver's license and everything else stored within their account.
So I want to get into the human part of this more, but with Radvinsky, Scott, maybe you could explain some of his past lawsuits. I guess in 2003 and 2004, Microsoft and Amazon sued him, and then he has a company, mm-hmm. Cyberstania, which is kind of shady. Give us the rundown.
Yeah, so I kind of mentioned it before a little bit, but he was known in the early 2000s kind of as like this notorious spammer. So he would take Amazon's, logo and their kind of website language and use it in spam emails to try and get people's contact info or try and get people's, people to sign up for his online porn websites. And so there's a bunch of other lawsuits that continue through the 2010s where he's basically accused of encroaching on a bunch of people's patents, either for software used on other online pornography websites. Oops. Sorry about that. And all of these lawsuits essentially end with him settling. So he'll just pay out the company that sued him, and that'll be the end of it. So the information kind of stops there. But there's numerous lawsuits he's been involved with leading up to the explosion of OnlyFans.
And he also, he bought OnlyFans, I guess, from Tim Barclay. And I guess right before he bought it, he received a $250,000 tax credit. What's that all about?
Yeah, so he is actually kind of a late addition to this. OnlyFans, like we said, it wasn't super popular until the pandemic, really, or close to it. But he bought the company in late 2018 from a guy named Tim Stokely, who, like you said, he's a banker, or the son of a banker. He has banking connections to Barclays, which is one of the biggest banks in the world. So Radvinsky, coming off of kind of success with his other company, MyFreeCams, he comes in and buys OnlyFans holding company, Phoenix International, in late 2018. And that's the exact same time where he gets a tax credit from the city of Chicago, where he lives and has like a bunch of residences now. So he was basically subsidized by the city of Chicago and the state of Illinois to buy OnlyFans, which is now, based on our reporting, stealing a ton of money from people.
And it's usually popular now because of the coronavirus, I guess, you know, so
totally,
it's making a ton of money. And Sophie, I'm just curious, and Scott, you can also answer this as well. How did this whole article come about? Sophie, did you pitch it, or Scott, did you go to Sophie and say you wanted to collaborate on this? How did this come about?
I think it was kind of a combination of both. Like, it was sort of like we wanted to do a piece on sex work. That was kind of the broad idea. And then I kind of went ahead and started just interviewing stripper friends and friends that I knew who had OnlyFans. But I didn't really have like an angle per se. I was sort of just going to take it as like a human interest story and try to kind of show what it's like to be a sex worker in today's day and age, especially during the pandemic. And then Scott kind of was like, hey, do you want to collab? Because it turns out the owner is stealing a bunch of money, and like he had a bunch of contacts that were validating that. So it kind of just turned into this big thing. And then we started going through lawsuits. We started doing background checks. And the more and more that we dug into it, the more and more corrupt things came up. And we decided that we were going to roll with it.
Yeah. So basically, like Sophie said, she was going to do a human element story on sex work in the age of coronavirus. And that's something that she pitched to me as something she wanted to do. And then OnlyFans got brought up because she had, you know, a couple friends that had accounts. And so I basically just Googled it one day, just looking, you know, for information about what it was. And I saw the shell company. And obviously that's like my nerdy, that's my nerdy alley that I love to go down. And I saw the shell company in the UK, and I was like, okay, this is interesting. Why is, you know, a guy based in Chicago using a UK shell company? And that kind of started the whole process. You know, we did research on who he was, did a background check on him, and that kind of just snowballed into looking into online complaints against OnlyFans. And then once we saw the online complaints that were public, we started to reach out to people who had like posted some things on Twitter, and the amount of people that were telling the exact same story made it clear to us, like, okay, there is a huge story here that nobody's really covering. And that's when we, you know, decided to kind of formulate this article in a more money-centric aspect.
So, Sophie, who were some of the people that you spoke to that had experiences with OnlyFans that were not on the positive side of things?
Well, there are several models that are quoted in our article that lost money. So, for example, an OnlyFans model named Taylor got $3,000 stolen out of her account. Another OnlyFans, Alyssa Higgins, another model, she got $18,000 stolen out of her account. I mean, the list just goes on. And then we also, so not only are the models being taken advantage of, but then we also have examples of patrons being taken advantage of. There was one user who was scammed out of $600 from OnlyFans. And then there was another user who only signed up for one account which was like a $5.50 fee or something for a month. And then he canceled it before that month was up. But then OnlyFans charged him 10 times the same day. And then it ended up being $210 for something that he didn't sign up for or consent.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Theft.
And there's been issues with models trying to withdraw their money as well, right?
So that's kind of like the main thing we've been hearing since publication. We did put it in the article, but I guess we should kind of walk through like how people are losing money. So the main story that we hear, and this, I can't even tell you how many people I've talked to now that this has happened to, probably more than 50 at this point, models, at least a few dozen. So they'll basically, the most common thing is they'll wake up one day and they can't log into their account. And it just says like access denied or incorrect password or something like that. And they email OnlyFans or they, you know, reach out to support on Twitter. And OnlyFans will send the exact same message to all these people saying, a really vague message saying something like, your account was permanently closed and everything was erased. And this is normally due to an allegation of fraud or a chargeback, like someone who signed up for that model requesting money back. And so this has happened dozens of times to dozens of models where OnlyFans essentially says, we close your account because of some vague issue that may or may not have violated our terms of service, which they don't, you know, the models obviously contest that. And OnlyFans just bluntly says all of your data was deleted and your account is no longer accessible. And the way the money is stolen is that the models keep their money in their OnlyFans account until they withdraw. So, you know, models can have anywhere from, you know, $50, I think, is the minimum to withdraw, or maybe 100 now, all the way up to thousands. And so if their account is deleted, like has happened to all these models, all the money that's in their pending balance that they haven't withdrawn yet to the bank is gone. And presumably that's kept with OnlyFans, the company.
And there's also been issues, I guess, with the security of the website for models and maybe even users. I know you referenced one model, Alyssa Higgins, who needed a refund after her, you know, account was hacked. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so there's a lot of reports of hacking, and like I would encourage people to just search on Twitter OnlyFans hack and just see how many complaints are pouring in of users, mostly models, mostly content creators as opposed to people who sign up for accounts, but that happens as well, where they complain that, you know, their accounts were hacked and oftentimes different bank accounts than they had on file, like their personal bank accounts, were switched to someone else. So obviously there was an intrusion in their account and the banking information was changed, the money gets siphoned out, and they're left with zero money. So, like I said, I would encourage anyone who listens to this to just look up on Twitter, on Instagram, on Google, even, like the reviews and the amount of people that are saying that, you know, their accounts on OnlyFans had unauthorized access. And we can speak, you know, we experienced that with when Sophie signed up for an account and, like, she got access. She could have logged into somebody else's account, even though, like, she had no affiliation with it. So it's a systemic problem with OnlyFans, and their security is awful.
Sophie, do you want to add anything to that? I know the data aspect of this is really kind of scary, because a lot of this data, I guess, can be shared with a third party, according to OnlyFans.
Yeah, no, it's very scary because there's a trust formed between content creators and content consumers. And if there's no, and then the third party would be the site that everybody's coming onto to get what they need. So if there's a breach of trust with the site between the creators or between the content creators and the content consumers, then it doesn't work. People don't get what they need. For instance, if somebody signs up for somebody's subscription, and then they end up screenshotting all that model's content and then selling it somewhere else. That's a huge breach of trust. And then more and more models are, they're not going to want to flock to OnlyFans. People aren't going to want to support that site. So it's just, it's kind of a downward spiral for everybody. It just needs to be brought to attention so less people are exploited.
And just to add to that, if I can, OnlyFans says on their website that they, so as part of the process, that they say they run to make sure people are 18 and make sure there's no fraud. They say they share data with third parties, and they don't identify who those third parties are. So, and the data that they share obviously is very specific and very like identifiable. They're, you know, people give them their full name. I think I have the list here. Full name, date of birth, and then usually, although not in our case, when we tried to sign up, passport or driver's license to confirm that you're the real person, your address, and usually a selfie to like confirm that you are who you say you are. And in the OnlyFans terms, they say that a lot of this information is shared with third parties. So if there is intrusion, you know, to somebody's account, then presumably more than just OnlyFans has access to that kind of data, which is obviously hugely scary to anyone that, you know, has their account taken over.
And I guess before we wrap up here, there is also a whole section on drug allegations, and that deals with a disgruntled model by the name of XOX Golden Fox. What's the story on that? Sophie, do you want to take that, or Scott, do you want to do that one?
I can take that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so XOX Golden Fox was a model on MyFreeCams, and she got fired from the platform for threats of violence on Twitter. So it's another example of a cam girl's account being taken away because of fraud or like random allegations that may or may not be real. She was a close friend of Rudvinsky, and she also knew his Russian-born friend, Alex Goykman, who I guess Alex and Rudvinsky, they spent a lot of time together. So she opened up to Forensic News and told us that there was this time that her and her friend were at their penthouse in New York, Rudvinsky and Goykman's penthouse, and they saw a bag of cocaine in the bathroom. And when they were getting ready to go, and they went downstairs to leave to go to a party, and the models told the two men that they found this cocaine, and they both froze up. And apparently, according to the model, they like freaked out, and they told the models that they hadn't tried it yet. And the models were starting to freak out because they were like, well, what do we just like, they didn't know what was about to happen. And it turns out that they had gotten this cocaine overseas. I think Spain was where they got it. And, she also attested that, they were crossing, Goykman and Rudvinsky were crossing the border into Canada, and they got caught at the border with cocaine, and Rudvinsky basically paid off the agent, so that Goykman wouldn't get, any allegations. So, yeah. And she swears, quote, I swear on every single dollar I have saved in my bank account that that story is true. So
wow,
we can see kind of where that money is going and being used.
Scott, do we really know much more about Rudvinsky other than, I mean, you describe him as the enigmatic owner of OnlyFans. We don't know if he's connected to other types of things.
That's one of the more interesting parts of this whole story is that we have one picture of him, and it's a really crappy picture, but we published it because nobody on the internet knows who he looks, what he looks like. And that's,
well, he's really kept himself off the radar.
100%.
Right. It was ridiculous, the lack of information that was available for a man with such power and such money. Mm-hmm. But what we were able to find was very interesting. I mean, he owns a lot of properties. He owns yachts, nice cars. I mean, this man is using his money. So, but we don't, again, we only have one picture of him. So it's,
and yeah, it's so interesting that this guy is now presumably a billionaire, or his net worth is more than a billion because he owns this company that, you know, revenue is greater than a billion, you know, at this point, or, you know, adds up to more than a billion. And we don't know anything about him, and nobody's writing about him. Nobody's looking into him. And like Sophie said, he's definitely using his money. He's buying a bunch of properties. We found out he has a yacht. Two yachts. Yeah. Two different yachts. And we don't know much about him. And, he obviously has, I want to phrase this carefully, but he has like Eastern European connections and friends. And we don't know if.
Well, I thought that when I heard you say Ukrainian. So.
Right. Yeah. It's not indicative of anything wrong.
Yeah, but, it doesn't necessarily mean anything.
No.
I mean, don't mistake me. I'm not trying to say Ukrainians are inherently criminal.
But, you know, if you take the allegations of wide-scale theft seriously, and we certainly do because we've heard it from so many people, and couple it with the fact that we don't know who this person is, really. And there's, like, in one of the lawsuits, it's super weird. He was served with a subpoena, and he referred to his girlfriend as his mom or something, so he was like trying to hide his familial connections, and so there's just a bunch of really weird things that, you know, we don't know who this person is. And now with the success of OnlyFans, he's uber rich and
uber rich, but he's not necessarily in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I hear podcasts like a Call Her Daddy podcast about OnlyFans, or when I hear my friends talk about OnlyFans, they really only quote the models who are making a lot of money. And it's almost like the fact that you can make a ton of money off this app is blinding people to all of these criminal offenses that the owner is being held to. So I think people need to start paying more attention to what's going on so that we can hold this man accountable.
And that's such a good point, because they've had a lot of really famous people sign up recently. Like Bella Thorne is the best example.
Cardi B as well, right?
Cardi B is now on the platform. There's off the top of my head, I don't know a lot more, but there's a ton of celebrities that are now joining and, like, obviously bringing attention to the platform as a whole. And so that usually captures the headlines, like, oh, you know, Bella Thorne made $2 million in one day on OnlyFans. Look how successful this you can be if you sign up. But we were trying to push Radvinsky's name into it more and focus more on the people that are being ripped off instead of, like, this new kind of platform that you know, major news organizations are writing about.
Yeah, that's what worries me about it. I was going to say real quick is the all these celebrities are getting into it now. And I wonder if some people are getting thrown under the bus or exploited or just screwed over by OnlyFans in some way because so much attention is being put on these celebrities and they're being catered to more than the other types of content creators.
Just real quick before Sophie jumps in, I would actually say it the other way. I think OnlyFans is courting these high name people, these high profile people who everyone knows, in order to cover up what they're doing. Because, like I said, all the attention goes on to the new creator, the famous person that has, you know, 10 million Instagram followers, instead of, like, the normal college student who's on the platform, who's being ripped off $500 and is struggling to pay rent because they rely on this money. So I just think that's an important point to make.
That's kind of what I was going to say. It's like, the unfortunate part about this article and about the fact that any of this is happening is that some of these models need that money. That money is what they're paying rent with. That money is what they're feeding their children with. Like, this isn't fun and games. Like, people need that money to survive. And yeah, Bella Thorne doesn't need $2 million more dollars. She's good, you know? But now, like, the headlines are focused on her and how much success she's making rather than, oh my goodness, this model just lost, you know, 18K. And then let's dive into why that model needed 18K and why this is a problem, you know? So I think, yeah, like Scott said, getting these high name ballers on this platform is kind of distracting from the criminal activity that's going on.
Sophie, there were just two more questions I wanted to ask you in particular. It sounds like you're very passionate about this story. And, you know, when I first announced that I was doing this show, some people being cynics said to me, well, is this really news? I mean, shady people have always been involved in the porn business. You go back to the 70s and that's how it was. So make your case. And I think you've already done it a little bit. But why should we care? I think we should. But for the naysayers, what would you say to them?
Well, why is it okay that the porn industry is viewed as shady? Why is that an acceptable thing? Sex work is valid work. Sex workers deserve rights. They deserve to be treated and compensated for the work that they do. So I think normalizing the porn industry to be shady or seedy, or that it's okay for these women or men to be stolen, or whoever to be stolen from because they use their body to make money, and for some reason our society views that as not valid, so then we excuse a lot of exploitative behavior. I don't think that's okay. I think that's something that we need to change our mindset as a whole, as like a whole society, and view these people as people who are working valid jobs. And so if they get ripped off, that's not any different from the 9-to-5 worker getting ripped off from their paycheck. It's the same exact thing. It's just that people have this moral tendency to discredit sex workers and to not want to deal with their problems. But they're valid problems, and I think we should care. Because like I was saying earlier, some models on this platform are using this money to survive. So it's kind of a life or death situation for some people.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because, you know, I have complex views on things like the porn industry. I don't really like it as an industry. I think it's very exploitative. But there's also women that, you know, they're doing this because it's the only way they can make some fast money that they need in order to survive. And, you know, you can have issues with the industry itself without, you know, punishing these women.
Oh, exactly. I think that's what this is all about. It's like, well, we don't need to be punishing the workers. We need to be holding those who exploit the workers accountable and showing governments that there need to be protective laws in place for these people. There need to be unions made. Like, it's like just accepting the porn industry to be shady and just accepting it that it's like, it's just exploitive. That's what it is. Like, that's just how it works. You can disagree with it, but you still have to acknowledge that these people are people and they deserve a certain amount of rights for the work that they do.
And there's are there male content creators, I assume, as well?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Scott, you were going to add something.
Yeah, I was just going to say a couple things. One, another reason why we should care is that, like I said, I really want to impress on people how big this company is and how widespread this, you know, these allegations of fraud and theft are. Like, if we were to add up all the money that we think has been stolen, I think it'd probably be in the millions at this point. And, you know, obviously some of the time it's $200, $300, but sometimes it's 18 grand, 30 grand. And so this adds up. And like we were talking about earlier, we don't know who this guy is, and he's kind of spending all this money on luxury goods and whatnot. And so if you look at, and, you know, to break some news on your podcast here, we've been in touch with a couple high profile lawyers who are interested in taking a huge case against OnlyFans, and they're in the process of interviewing some of the same models that we've talked to. And so if you look at potential crimes here, I mean, it goes beyond theft. Like, if he's defrauding people based on these practices, then by definition, he's by buying this, the properties and the yachts and stuff, he's laundering the money. And like we talked about earlier, we don't know what his political affiliations are or connections. And so there's a ton of like potential money laundering, you know, like we said, fraud, theft, all this white collar crime where this guy could go to jail for a long time if these allegations are proven true. And, you know, $1 billion-plus company is the focus.
And you guys reached out to Radvinsky and got no response.
Right. The only response I got was being blocked by the OnlyFans official Twitter. So I think that's enough response as it is.
So last question here for Sophie. With regards to the interviews that you did, and the sort of human element. I'm just curious, you know, as a journalist or as a media person, we're always faced with issues of how we talk to our interviewees. And, you know, some interviewees can get emotional when talking about, you know, getting ripped off or having been, you know, wronged in some way. How do you sort of approach your interviewees in a human way that isn't exploitative? Because I feel like we need to talk about that more in journalism.
Yeah, absolutely. The best way to go into an interview, in my idea, is just to state who you are and what your intentions are, so that there's no convoluted idea of what they say is going to go somewhere else, or like they know exactly what they're going to get within this interview, and they have the option to either be anonymous or to have their name in the article. So I think right off the bat, identifying yourself, identifying your intent, and giving them the option to either be anonymous or to be seen will kind of help them understand why you're there, what your goal is, and give them kind of autonomy in the interview. And then from there, just honestly enter it with confidence and enter it with empathy as well, because you're talking to another person, right? So you just have to be confident that the questions that you have prepared will get you certain answers. But then if you talk to them with empathy and you talk to them with compassion and you're talking to them like a human, eventually that interview is going to turn into more of like a dialogue and less of like question, boom, answer, boom, question, boom, answer, boom. And you're going to get more information from the person because they're going to feel comfortable around you and they're going to feel like you're a credible source and you're a trustworthy source and you're a source that's not going to exploit them and their answers. So yeah, just identifying yourself and then giving them the option of anonymity or being in the public eye and then making them feel comfortable and like they're respected and what they have to say is valued.
Yeah, and I was just going to add to that. I like that you mentioned the empathy and compassion bit, because I think sometimes, at least in popular culture, there's this really negative portrayal of journalists as sort of being vulturous or like preying on people for a story. And I don't really think that's how good journalists actually approach things. I think that's sort of the negative media image that we get sometimes from movies and TV.
Oh, yeah.
It's a negative image for sure, but it is done sometimes in practice. And so I think, like Sophie said, you know, staying empathetic and, you know, it's not just being a good person, which it is, but it's also good business, because if you're empathetic and you actually listen, and I think that's another key point, is like actually listen. Obviously, you go into an interview wanting to get information on certain topics, but if you listen to the person and kind of guide the conversation as to what they're why they're interested in talking to you, I think is important. And again, like keep the human element, but it's also good business, because if you listen to them, you're going to get good information.
Mm-hmm. And you guide with questions. Like a reporter's job is to ask questions. It's not to talk and to share your opinions about anything.
Right.
So when you go into an interview, 90%, 95%, of the interview is you asking questions and then letting them fill up the space with what they have to say and staying engaged with them through. I mean, if it's over social media, like it's a little less, but if it's an in-person interview, like eye contact, body language, like all of that. Mm-hmm.
In a way, I think a reporter, it's not their job to like be the one telling the story. That's what the interviewees do. But then the reporter puts it into a context and sort of relays it to the reader.
Yeah, exactly. We kind of synthesize what outside sources say, what our interviewees say, the context. We synthesize that all into very digestible sentences for our readers, like very short, very concise, very clear sentences that just get the point across.
I think the ideal like piece of journalism is the journalist acting kind of as a vessel for confirmed information that they hear from sources, from documents, and just synthesizing, like we said, and also putting it in a narrative form, because a lot of times you'll get bits and pieces from one person, one interview that lines up with something else that someone else said or something a document said. And so a lot of it is just organization. And so, like I said, acting as a vessel for the confirmed information that you have and organizing and putting it in a way that, and this, I still struggle with this sometimes, but putting it in a way where the readers can understand what you're talking about, and making it into a story instead of just a set of facts.
Well,
it's storytelling with facts.
I like that. Storytelling with facts. So in closing, I just want to let my listeners know how they can, you know, keep up with your work, Scott and Sophie.
Yeah, so our main website, forensicnews.net. My Twitter is Scott M. Stedman. And also, like, if anyone listening to this has a story about OnlyFans, we definitely want to hear it. So you can DM me on Twitter or reach out on forensicnews.net.
Mm-hmm. And then my Twitter is at Sophie_J_Pierce. And you can find all my stories on Forensic News. But yeah, I'll also be, I mean, I'm still a college student, so I'm still like kind of finding my niche. So I'll be writing for a bunch of different outlets over my years.
Well, I'm looking forward to what you achieve in journalism in the coming years, Sophie. And I really appreciate that you wrote this article with Scott. It gives me a lot of hope for journalism. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
And thank you, Scott and Sophie, for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Well, there you have it. OnlyFans, or is that only scams? You be the judge, folks. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Scott and Sophie. I am thoroughly impressed by the work they are doing at Forensic News. They are, as I said, very young and very ambitious. They are hungry journalists that are out to shake things up, and I really appreciate that. Next up, we change our focus a little bit as we discuss the recent Deutsche Bank report warning of a coming age of disorder that will disrupt and perhaps even reverse the processes of globalization. Joining us to discuss that, as mentioned in the show intro, is Charles U. Smith, author of The Hacker's Teleology and proprietor of the Of Two Minds blog. How did we reach this moment of economic precarity? And what does the future potentially hold? Well, hopefully, Charles will give you an inkling of the possibilities and the answers to those questions in the following conversation. So, without further ado, my conversation with Charles U. Smith of the Of Two Minds blog. Welcome to Parallax Views, Charles U. Smith, author of The Hacker's Teleology and proprietor of the popular alternative finance website Of Two Minds. How are you doing today, Charles?
Great. Thank you very much for inviting me on the program.
So, Charles, I wanted to have you on because I've been reading your blog lately, and I've been trying to keep up with a lot of the sort of financial and economic concerns going on now in light of COVID. And, you know, I noticed, what was it, a week or so ago, it feels like, you know, forever. Every week feels like an eternity now in the age of COVID. But I noticed that Deutsche Bank came out with a report from Jim Reed saying that we are facing an age of disorder. And I guess this ties into your work because you wrote about it on your blog. I don't know where you want to start. Maybe we can start with, what is this age of disorder that Deutsche Bank and Jim Reed are talking about, and how does it tie into your perspective?
Well, that's a great question. And of course, I think that I would be guessing that Jim Reed has also read the work of historian Peter Turchin, who wrote a book called, you know, The Age of Disorder, or The Coming Age of Disorder. And so there's a lot of historical work that's been done on, you know, cycles and which I think we all intuitively understand, right? You know, there's prosperity and then everybody's doing well. And then sort of rot sets into the system, you know, with inefficiencies, greed, inequality, these kinds of things start rotting away. And then a pandemic hits or something, you know, a war. And then there's a decline in and a slump into some sort of crash or reboot, reset kind of stage. And so I think that's what Jim Reed was writing about. And he very succinctly broke it down into 8 different trends that he felt were feeding the age of disorder.
And I'm going to pull up those 8 trends just to give my listeners an idea here. Let me see. So the first one is deteriorating U.S.-China relations and the reversal of unfettered globalization, a make-or-break decade for Europe with muddle through less likely following the economic shock of COVID-19. Number 3, even higher debt and MMT/helicopter money becoming mainstream. 4, inflation or deflation, ? As a minimum, it is unlikely it will calibrate as easily as we saw over the last few decades. 5, inequality worsening before a backlash and reversal takes place. 6, the intergenerational divide also widening before millennials and younger voters soon start having the numbers to win elections and in turn reverse decades of policy. 7, linked to the above, the climate debate will build with more voters sympathetic and thus creating disorder to the current world order. And 8, we're in the midst of a technological revolution with astonishing equity valuations reflecting expectations for a serious disruption to the status quo. Revolution or bubble? ? Just breaking this down a bit, I guess the biggest takeaway for a lot of people was the generational divide aspect. What do you make of that generational divide between millennials and younger and the older generations? Do you think some people are making too much of this, or do you think it's on point?
Yeah, it's a great topic. Let's tie in those demographic themes with some of the other topics that Jim raised, which would be globalization and financialization, which is kind of a catch-all for all those things that happened from 1980, you know, the deregulation of financial industries and the sort of massive incentivization of things like stock buybacks and this kind of thing. So I think that part of what's feeding that demographic divide is that the baby boomers benefited from financialization and globalization. In other words, they bought their homes for less than $100,000 and they got the good corporate managerial jobs or worked their way up. They started businesses when there was less regulation and fewer costs on small business. So they were kind of in the right place at the right time, and then they've benefited enormously, right? Where the millennials got the raw end of that exact same stick, right? In other words, like the economy started falling apart first in 2000, right? When the oldest millennials were starting to enter the workforce. And it's been a roller coaster ride since. And they've never had the opportunity that the boomers had to buy houses for really low prices.
Yeah, the prices haven't even gone down after the housing crisis. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they barely dipped, right? And then there was other structural changes that have really put pressure on millennials, like the student loan thing. I mean, like, you know, 30 years ago, there were no student loans because college was affordable and there was none of this financial structure to sort of turn everybody into what I call a debt surf, right? And so there's almost $2 trillion that didn't exist before of debt, and it's all focused on young people, most of it, right? So I think that divide is real, and people are responding to something that's real and structural. In other words, it's not just that the old folks got all the wealth. It's how they got the wealth. That's unfair.
Now, do you agree with Reed that this generational divide is going to worsen? The way it's been reported by some media outlets is that, you know, there's going to be a massive redistribution of wealth by younger generations when they have more of the vote. Do you think we're moving in that direction, or is that too apocalyptic? I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question, because it gets right to the point. And the point is, there's huge wealth and income inequality in the U.S., right? We know that, and that's a big issue. But the demographics of it is that most of the wealth is held by older people for the reasons I said. They basically got in at the right time, and so their wealth has been boosted by these structural trends that diminished opportunities for millennials. And so when we say, well, we're going to address wealth inequality, we're actually talking about a demographic transfer of wealth as well. Now, the interesting thing to me is, in an age of disorder, a lot of the what I call phantom wealth will vanish. You know, in other words, like the bungalow that used to be $100,000 in Brooklyn or San Francisco that's now $1 million. Well, things can change, and that can go back to being worth $200,000. And so a lot of the wealth that people are looking at is actually phantom. You know, it's based on bubbles. And so how much is going to be left if the bubbles pop for the millennials to claw back? That's one of the questions I have.
I was going to say, I know some millennials that are thinking, oh, well, everything will be fine once our boomer parents pass and then we'll inherit their wealth. And I don't think it's that simple.
Exactly, because of these structural trends we're talking about that they can reverse. And I think they are reversing. And I think that's basically what Jim Reed's article is about, is looking at these big structural trends, globalization, automation, financialization, demographics, and saying they're all reversing. And the way I kind of visualize it is, you know, it's like a pendulum, right? And so it's swung to this extreme where, you know, we've got people with fortunes of $100 billion, right? And then they're, and that kind of thing. And then it's going to swing back, right? And so in swinging back, it has the opportunity to be beneficial, frankly. You know, in other words, like, let's say we could claw back some of the wealth that's accumulated at the top of the heap and use it to benefit society. I mean, obviously, I think we're all in favor of that. And let's face it, if somebody has $5 billion and they get taxed $1 billion, that's really not going to, you know, send them to the poorhouse.
So when we're talking about the statistics of this widening gap between the haves and the have-nots, I keep hearing about the top 1% versus the bottom 80%. Maybe you could elaborate on that, because I know you have a lot of graphs on the website that deal with this.
Yeah, and I can send some of those to you after we finish recording if you want to post them. It seems like there's a lot of charts that divide it into the top 10% and the bottom 90%. And of course, that's a pretty easy divide, because the bottom 90% are wage earners, right? Everybody that's selling their labor, right? They're an employee, or they're earning money from their work. And the top 10% are the managers and professionals and entrepreneurs who, or the inherited wealth, who earn unearned income, right? Like they're getting dividends, or they own bonds that give them a yield, and so on. So it's kind of that ownership thing is part of it, is what I'm saying. It's what assets do you own? And if all you own is your labor, you've been left behind, because the value of labor's actually gone nowhere or declined since 1980. And I was just looking at a chart that says that. So the top 0.1%, which is the real ownership class in America, their income's gone up 350%. The bottom 90 has gone up 20%. But that's if you include real inflation. I think it's obvious that the bottom 90 has lost ground, right? They're actually earning less. And I can tell you, the way I do this is, because I'm an old guy, so I've been working for 50 years. So I remember when I started work in 1970, what the minimum wage could buy. So back even in like the 70s, I could rent my own apartment in an expensive city for half a week's pay. Well, now, can you rent your own apartment for a half week's pay if you're kind of, and you're not really paid well? No, you're going to spend like 2 weeks' pay to rent your own apartment or
and
more.
And then you can't really save money and yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So if you look at what the hours of work could buy in the 70s and 80s and what they can buy now, you realize labor, paid work, has just really been hammered, right? And all the wealth has been sluiced into the very top, the financialization stuff, right? Stock buybacks and all that stuff. And so even in the top 10%, I want to talk to this real quickly. You know, you've probably seen these articles, which kind of look like, oh, poor me, right? You know, where people are saying, gee, I make $300,000 and I'm barely making it, you know, in New York City or Seattle or, you know, the big cities where things are really expensive. And so by the time they take care of their student loans and their childcare and all this other stuff, they're broke earning 300 grand. So they're in the top 5%, but they're not really getting ahead, right? And so I think it's really like the top 0.1% has garnered most of the gains. And that's what all the charts say. And the top 1% has done pretty well for themselves. But I get email from people who are entrepreneurs or professionals earning like a $500,000. And they say, you know what? I don't have any political power. I'm in the 1%, but I can't call up my congressperson and have them, you know, put in some kind of tax rider that gives me a big break. And so we have to realize that the political power that protects wealth is actually owned only by the top 0.1%. So even the top 1% are most of them are powerless in the political system.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking to my father yesterday, and we were talking about billionaires. And, you know, he follows like sports and whatnot. So he mentioned to me this wrestling promoter, Vince McMahon, who's, I guess, worth something like $1.2 billion. And he said, you know, what's crazy is you would need 62 Vince McMahons to make one George Soros. It is crazy when you think about how there's an even more upper crust of the upper crust out there that's even smaller and more minute in numbers.
You're absolutely right. And I think the Amazon stock fell recently. So Jeff Bezos' fortune fell from 200 billion, but say it's now only 150 billion. Well, what if what 1% of that would be 1.5 billion. I mean, that's an immense fortune. I mean, what can you do with 1.5 billion? And so you're right. And so this is where people are talking about the Gilded Age and so on. But my interest is, and I think this is Jim Reed's article, it speaks to what the same topic, which is why. And you can say, well, people are greedy and all that stuff about human nature. Yes, humans have always been greedy. They've been interested in conspicuous consumption and so on. But I think it's more than that. It's the way our economy has changed beneath the surface. And so like this author, Peter Turchin, he mentions a couple things that he thinks are core to every age of disorder, you know, going back 3,000 years. One is government finances start decaying, you know, like governments start you know, taking the silver out of their coinage, they start printing money, you know, and so their finances start decaying and they're less able to respond. And then there's what he calls an oversupply of parasitic elites. I would have to say he's not really mincing words, right? And so, and I think that I don't consider them parasitic, but I think we can look at elites like college grads, you know, and that's another thing where the millennial generation is in a different situation than two generations before. Back in the 70s, there were only 15% of the American workforce had a college degree. Now it's like 60%, right? Or 40% and 60 some percent have some college experience. And so
I've heard people, I've heard people say that we're almost overproducing students with degrees now, or workers with degrees.
Yeah, absolutely. That like say two generations ago, if you had a college degree like mine in a worthless subject like philosophy, you know, you still had more opportunities than if you had a high school degree, right? Because you had a scarce commodity, a college degree. Well, so that's no longer the case. And in fact, you've got, I don't know, you probably heard this too, but even people with PhDs are struggling to find jobs. And it, and so now it's like this pyramid where, say within academia, you know, like if you use, like, again, a generation ago, if you got a PhD, even in a kind of, you know, remote subject, you could eventually get a position in some college, right? And hope for tenure track. Well, now that's just gone. You have to come from one of the top 5 or 10 universities in the world. And even then you're going to find there's 100 other people just as qualified as you for a tenure track position at a big university. So that's an example of the kind of like result, as you say, oversupply of credentials. And so then everybody with a master's is like waiting tables. Well, they used to be waiting tables.
So I want to get into how this all happened, but since you mentioned Peter Turchin, I've been interested in delving into his work more. I'm curious, what's the basic outline in a nutshell? I know you gave a little bit of background there, but I've been curious about it because it sounds like generational type theory, but I get the impression it's a little different than, say, Neil Howe and the Fourth Turning, or maybe it's similar, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm really happy you asked that question because, you know, there's a lot of people who are skeptical of cycles, right? They say, well, that's just, you guys are just adding some lines to chaotic history.
Or it seems like it's like a repeat of, you know, Arnold Toynbee or maybe, you know, yeah. Oswald Spengler. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But those guys were onto something. And what Turchin has tried to do, and a lot of people disagree with him, but what he's tried to do is say, hey, look, I'm doing science. This is not opinion. I'm doing science. And so what he's done is he's correlated these ups and downs in economic and political stability by using things like coin hoards. You know, like when you discover like a hidden can of gold coins, that you and then you can date the coins, then you can say, well, look at why were people burying those their wealth? Well, they were afraid, right? There was warfare, there was disorder, there was political conflict, etc. So it turns out that if you date these coin hoards around the world, they do align with periods of great turmoil, the fall of empires or the pandemic in the Roman Empire, this kind of thing. So he's claiming that there's a scientific basis for the idea that all societies and economies have a growth cycle and a decline cycle. And, you know, as you say, this idea has long roots, and there's people that the generational cycles of, as you say, of the Fourth Turning. Turchin's cycles are a little shorter. He's using like 50 years and 100 years and 150 years, that kind of thing. But it's pretty easy to align that. And so he's saying, hey, look, at when was the last great period of turmoil and disorder in America? And it was like the 60s, early 70s, right? Vietnam, civil rights, Watergate. And he says 50 years right here, you know, 1970 to 2020, bang on, we're going to start the same thing. And we're seeing it already. So
it sounds like there's, based on what I've been told, and I've been told by multiple sources this, whether it's – I've even had Marxists say this to me, that Peter Turchin seems to have a lot of predictive power. And that's coming from Marxists. That's surprising because I don't think they're on the same page as him. But it's really interesting to hear his name coming up more and more.
Yeah, and that's true. I kind of discovered him when some publisher said, would you like to read his next book? Because they'd seen me reference him on on my site. And so I got a review copy. And, but another guy that, another historian that's, you might've heard of is, David Hackett Fisher. And he wrote a book about a decade or 15 years ago called, the Great, Great Price Wave or something like that. And, what he was doing was saying, he looked at prices because he said, when inflation kicks up and prices start rising, you get disorder, you get revolution, you get collapse. And so, and I think there's something to that too, as we're talking about that you're, you know, the hours of work you put in are buying less and less, right? And so, like Fisher pointed out that the Bastille in the French Revolution, you know, they tore down the Bastille, the prison, on the day that the price of bread peaked in Paris. Like it was unaffordable. You know, like regular people could no longer sustain themselves. And so then you have to overthrow.
I've heard there were actually correlations between food shortages and the Arab Spring, actually, too. So, yeah, I'm familiar with this.
Yeah, that's even a much better example because it's much more recent. So when Jim Reed mentions globalization, we all know it's decaying, and you can look at a bunch of charts, and it's like global trade is slowing, not just between the U.S. and China, but everywhere, right? And so one of the things, I'll bring up another famous author, Nassim Taleb, right, who wrote most recently Anti-Fragile, right?
Oh, that's the Black Swan theorist.
Yeah, the Black Swan guy, right. And his latest book was called Anti-Fragile because what he's saying is some systems are fragile, some are anti-fragile. And the fragile systems are more likely to get disrupted by disorder. And so he's saying the global economy is very fragile. And what he talks about is how when things get interdependent, and so when it's like dominoes, right? And so what he's saying is that the global economy is really interdependent now. Everybody's dependent on the same, you know, if one domino falls, all the major economies are going to go down.
And, now, is that why it's slowing right now, the globalization process, because of these sort of problems that arise from it?
Yeah, that's what he's saying is when the systems are tightly bound, like interconnected, then a disruption in one, like say Europe's slowing economy, well, that eventually or that very quickly starts impacting the U.S. and China and the same thing. And so they're all interconnected. So when you talk about food shortages, people may not be aware that, you know, the global food system is really interconnected and interdependent as well. So if there's a really bad weather somewhere in a major grain growing area, that could impact, you know, global prices, not just in that country or their neighbors.
So in terms of how we got here, I'm one of these left-leaning guys. So I sometimes I think I oversimplify it. I say, you know, the rise of neoliberalism and the Mount Pelerin Society and Reagan. What, though, for you, do you think has led us to this point? It's probably a little bit more complicated than how I've just laid it out in my head.
No, I don't think so. And I'll preface by saying, you know, I get it because I'm kind of like non-ideological. Some people say, you know, you're like a Marxist. And because I often refer to Marx, I learned a lot from him, right? I mean, his analysis of capitalism was brilliant for being composed in the 1860s, right? A lot of what he had to say has turned out to be true. His predictions about what lies beyond capitalism didn't turn out to be true, but you know, that doesn't negate his analysis. But then I'm called a libertarian and I'm called a conservative. So anyways, I agree with you about neoliberalism. I think the way I would describe it is this. At the end of what the French called the glorious 30 years, which the world had this glorious 30 years of growth from 1950 to, you know, somewhere between 1945 and 1975, right? Everybody was growing. Well, part of that was cheap oil. And part of it was when you don't have any credit, then you can't really invest. But once you get credit, well, wow, then you can invest and then your economy grows really fast. But those have an end point, you know, like at some point you've borrowed more than you can invest productively, right? And so your economy starts stagnating. And that's what happened to America in the 70s. Oil prices went up because of, you know, geopolitical. And then there was just no place to put money that was productive. So then the debt starts becoming a burden. Well, so in response, then it was like neoliberalism. Well, let's just deregulate finance and borrow more and speculate. That's basically what happened. Is let's speculate instead of actually being productive. And that's the world we've created, a world based on speculation. And so all these things that used to be safe, like a college education, well, it's been financialized. And in other words, somebody's basically exploiting students and skimming money, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars off students. And it's all like, well, how did we let this happen? And it's like, well, we turned into a society that lives off speculation, not actual productive use of money and labor.
I was wondering, so for a lay audience that may they may hear the word financialization, or they may hear the word speculation. How would you parse that out for someone who is completely new to this stuff?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you for that. I'm going to just use housing as a simple example. Like, you know, back in the day, then the bank loaned you money, the bank kept that mortgage. And then they earned a little bit of interest off of it. And, you know, they could then afford to pay interest on their savings accounts and so on. Well, what financialization did was the bank took that mortgage from your house, packaged it in with a couple of hundred of other mortgages, many of which were, subprime. And then it sold it to some pension fund in Norway. So it doesn't have the debt anymore. So the incentives change. It was like, well, how do I make a lot of money? Well, you originate a whole bunch of mortgages. You don't care whether the person is qualified or not. You make your money by originating the mortgage and then selling it to some investor. And so that's what financialization does, is it looks around for like, what can we turn into a global market and then exploit, make our quick money and then disappear? You know, and that's what happened with the mortgage market. And then what happens when you do financialize something, well, eventually you get a speculative bubble and it blows up, and then it hurts a lot of people. That's what's wrong with financialization. And the same thing with student loans, right? It started out being some kind of small thing, and then now it's a major industry and it's going to blow up. It's a bubble and it's going to pop. And then everybody that bought those student loans as investments is going to get hurt. It was a fraud, really.
So getting back to the Reed article then, in dealing with these crises that have been created, you know, over the decades, it seems like we've been having a slow burn, a build to this current moment, this age of disorder, or as you put it, the age of uncertainty. And maybe we can parse that out in a second, why you call it the age of uncertainty. But first, Reed mentions this issue of helicopter money and MMT, or modern monetary management. I still don't completely understand MMT, but why is it becoming more popular, and what are your thoughts on it? Because there's a lot of debate right now.
Yeah, well, that's a terrific topic as well. And I don't claim to be an expert on MMT, but the basic idea here is that you can create money in a couple ways. One is you can borrow it into existence, which is what the central banks do and what the Treasury does. You know, like the U.S. Treasury, when it needs money to, you know, for a deficit, it sells a bond. And so that's a debt, right? It's that the Treasury is obligated to pay interest on that and so on. So they're borrowing money into existence. MMT says, why don't we just not borrow it into existence? Because then we have to pay interest and then we have to pay back the lump sum. Why don't we just print it? Just, you know, the Treasury has the legal authority to just print money, and we'll just print the money and distribute it. And so that's kind of the innovation, if you will, of MMT in a nutshell. But a lot of people are skeptical, because usually when governments are able to print as much money as they want, then it causes hyperinflation, like in Venezuela and Zimbabwe, and then the money loses all of its value and everybody's wealth is destroyed and the economy is destroyed. So that's the danger. Now, the proponents of MMT say, no, we can stop inflation by just printing less if we see inflation rising. But I'm skeptical of that, because the political pressure to keep printing will be immense. No one's going to take less money than they got the day before. So that's my concern, is the political pressure to keep printing more will be irresistible.
So in that regard, you posted a blog today, "Inflation and Socialism Light Are Just What the Billionaires Want." Are you referring to MMT when you talk about socialism light? How does this all tie together? And why would the billionaires be wanting socialism light? I think some people are going to be surprised to hear that.
Yeah, I think so too. Well, let's start by saying what's real socialism and what's socialism light. And so real socialism is ownership, public ownership of the means of production. So meaning like the factories, the mines, Amazon, Google, Twitter, Facebook, all owned by the government. That's socialism. Or by a government, public-private, you know, company, where the things that create wealth are owned by the government, which represents the people. That's socialism, right? And so, but in the modern era, we've sort of lost sight of what real socialism means, and it's now been associated with like Scandinavian capitalism, where high taxes fund a big social safety net, right?
For a welfare
state. The government funds
yeah.
stuff. Yeah, the welfare state. That's what people in America think of as socialism. So we're sort of stuck with that misconception to start with. And so what I think, why the billionaires love socialism light, which is MMT or universal basic income, that kind of thing, where everybody or every household is going to get $1,000 a month or $2,000 a month. And is it takes the pressure off them, because no one's going to be coming after them for taxes, which of course they have the political power to evade. They can just stand back and watch the government print endless trillions to keep everybody, you know, from overthrowing the government. What we call bread and circuses, because that's what they called it in Rome, right? When the Roman government gave everybody free bread and put on these huge spectacles for free. And so the billionaires are happy with that, because no one's actually coming after them, their wealth, right? They can evade the taxes.
I was going to comment real quickly on that.
Yeah.
I've been trying to say to some people recently that, you know, I don't think, for instance, the Davos crowd is necessarily completely against something like social democracy. I was just talking to a sociologist who deals with issues related to the World Economic Forum, Davos, etc., and he said, "No, they're probably going to be willing to do some kind of social democratic reforms or push for them, just so there's not social upheavals."
Yeah, I think you're right. And so we ask, well, how do we get to a point where people are taken care of, and there's less disorder in social, you know, how do we diffuse the powder keg, right? And what I'm saying is, what works best for the billionaires is not like a 60 or 90% tax, which is the, if you weren't going to borrow the money or create it with MMT, where are you going to get the trillions we need to redistribute? Well, you're going to have to go after and claw it back from the wealthy. You're going to have to impose something like on the order of, say, a 50% wealth tax. You know, in other words, like, you got 10 billion, well, we're taking 5. It's like, or we're taking 9, whatever. And so, if the government is going to step in and just print money or create it out of thin air, well, then that the billionaires will like that. And then the other reason they're going to like it is it will create inflation, I think. And they own all the assets that do well in inflation, right? They own the timber, they own the farmland, they own the ranch land, they own the mines, they own the gold. And the regular people, you know, the bottom 95%, we own very little of that stuff. I mean, the only thing we own is our house, you know, basically. And so they're going to do very well. And so my concern is, you could end up with, if you get runaway inflation, our society and economy could get even more unequal, because everything that would go up with inflation is owned by the wealthy.
The land, for the timber, degree. Railroads, all that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The stuff that you can raise the prices of to keep up with inflation. And you could put in Google, Facebook, and Twitter, you know, social media, same thing, you know, who's ever creating the wealth, it's mostly owned by the wealthy already. So that's my concern with that. And that's why I think the billionaires would like this kind of reform that's based on the government borrowing. But like Turchin said, that puts the government finances in a downward spiral, you know, and that's
how
the danger.
So maybe you could explain that a little bit.
You know, the inflation is, you know, bad for people with that are just wage earners, right? Because prices go up, your wages usually don't go up by the same degree. So the government, if it creates inflation, everyone seems to be saying, oh, that's going to be fine, right? But it eventually the government gets in a bind, because it has to pay interest on all this debt. And eventually, if the interest goes up, you know, then pretty soon all the government's resources are just going to pay rich people interest on all this debt that they acquired. And so Japan is an interesting example because people say, well, Japan doesn't have any inflation and they've been printing money, you know, for 40 years. And it's all like, yeah, but look at their economy. It's completely stagnant. You know, like there's very little opportunity for young people there. And there's a lot of social malaise in Japan. Young people aren't interested in marrying, having kids because they can't afford it. So Japan is not a success story, despite the fact it's borrowed, you know, huge amounts of money and has a huge debt load.
You know, you mentioned universal basic income, and I wanted to get to that because there's something about that idea that I'm very skeptical of it because it seems like, okay, you have Andrew Yang saying, oh, we'll give everyone this amount of money, everyone across the board. Well, there's going to be people that get that money, but they're unemployed and there's really no other way they can spend it other than to spend it on, you know, the basic living expenses. Whereas other people will get that check and be able to spend it because they already own some things. And it seems like it would actually contribute to more inequality. Maybe I'm getting that wrong, but.
No, I think you've just hit on a very profound reason, you know, why we should question, you know, universal basic income.
I guess what I'm saying is I almost feel like it's not to quote Hayek, but it's almost like the road to serfdom in a way.
Yeah, there's that too. But, you know, just as you said, well, the way I look at it is it's actually just a scam to make sure that the debt serfs can continue to make their credit card and student loan payments. That's what I think. I think it's basically a thing where everybody, you get $1,000, but you only get that money if you keep making your credit card and student loan debts payments. And so it's actually a giveaway to the banks and the people who, you know, who are benefiting from all this debt. You know, because if you don't get universal basic income, there's going to be a lot of people who are just going to default and say, I'm not paying my student loan debt. I don't have the money. And I'm going to default on my credit card and my auto loan too. And so the banks are like, wow, what do we do to make sure everybody's got enough money to pay us? And it's all like, hey, universal basic income. But I think you're also right that it what's the incentive structure it creates? That's what you're speaking about, right? Where's the incentive structure? And obviously, if you don't have to work, then you probably won't. And then there's this whole fake thing of, oh, everyone's going to become an entrepreneur or a poet or something. And it's all like, I don't think so. I mean, you know, humans, you know, I some people will be creative with their universal basic income, but most people will just be scraping by. As you say, I think it will increase inequality.
Well, the other aspect of this is that, and maybe this is my sociologist coming out or anthropologist, but this idea of, well, let's just let the robots do the work for us. I don't think people want that. I think people want to feel as if they're contributing to their community and being worthwhile. I know there's that idea that, oh, people are just naturally lazy. But I think in general, people want to feel like they're a part of their community, and they usually do that through work. So I'm curious as to what you think of my idea there.
I'm totally for it. And in fact, that's what all my last couple books are about, that, you know, this, the hacker's teleology and a radically beneficial world. My whole idea is, hey, look it, why don't we create work that benefits the community and pay people for doing that? Because there's a lot of work that's not paid in our society, right? You get paid to make Jeff Bezos richer. Well, why don't you get paid to make your community better? And it's like, I think we could do that. And that's what I write about, because I think you're absolutely right. If you just give people who don't have a chance to contribute and participate and earn the dignity, you know, of contributing and work, well, then what do you get? You get a person who's depressed and gets addicted to opioids. It's not like you make people happy with giving them free money. You actually make them miserable, right? Because you've taken away the opportunity to be part of a social group, you know, and people want to do something meaningful, you know, like David Graeber, you know, the author that yes. just passed away. And, you know, he wrote about that book on, you know, BS work, right? I mean, everybody knows most of the work that gets paid in our society is BS. people know it's not purposeful or meaningful or contributing to the community or the nation. You know, it's just BS work. So I think there's a huge opportunity here to pursue what you just said. Yeah, why don't we have a system that creates paid work for doing meaningful, purposeful work that contributes to the community?
Now, I want to get into maybe some solutions that we can use to address these crises. But I want to go back to the issue of the super wealthy and, you know, this PR about we'll just have more of a wealth tax. Why do you view that as sort of a cynical PR move?
Well, the way I look at it,
maybe
I'm
putting it a little bit bluntly there, but I think that's where you're going with it.
No, I think you hit it right on the head. And I think what is the super wealthy, of course, have like, you know, the best advice and the best attorneys. And so they know how to protect their wealth, right? In what I call philanthrocapitalist foundations, right? You put your $50 billion in some foundation and then, you know, use it to influence things. And it's not, it's a foundation. It's not intaxable. It's not my wealth anymore. That kind of stuff. And there's a lot of tricks to protect huge fortunes. And so what I think is going to happen is it's going to be like the entrepreneurial class that's going to get nailed by a wealth tax, you know, because they're not rich enough to buy political cover, but they're rich enough to be in everybody's target, you know? So say somebody that makes $1 million, you know, like a sports person or an entertainer, they're going to get nailed. But the person making $1 billion, oh no, that's protected, you know? That's what I anticipate, because that's the problem with our system is it's pay to play, totally. You know, that democracy is dead. I mean, there's been studies, right, that politicians don't really care what the 99% think. They really don't. They have to get contributions, and so they listen to lobbyists and the super wealthy, and that's how they vote. So that's the system we have. So
yeah, I was going to say real quickly,
yeah.
I just had a guest on by the name of Thomas Ferguson, who was at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He wrote a book called Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Party Competition, which, you know, it's considered controversial within academia. But what he's basically saying is that different forms of finance and capital support different kinds of candidates, and that has a big impact on the elections. So big money in politics. And I know a lot of academics say, oh, you know, really we have the median voter theory, but it seems like money does impact these things.
Yeah, when you read that, when you read freshman Congress people saying that they're surprised when 60% of their time is spent calling contributors from day one. It's like, well, why? You know, so yeah, it's, I think it is corrupt, and you can't blame any one group for it. It's like the way the system is set up, right? So
it's very deeply structural.
Yes. And so yeah, you're right on.
So getting into solutions here, and then we'll start to wrap up. A Hacker's Teleology, that's your new book, Sharing the Wealth of Our Shrinking Planet. I have to be honest, when I heard teleology, I was a bit put off because I'm always debating with people about teleology. So why a Hacker's Teleology? Sell me on this.
Okay. You know, a hacker, we now... hacker is usually a negative term, right? Somebody trying to break into a system and do something malicious, right? But
I like the hackers. They gave us the Panama Papers and all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. There's and when we use the word hack, like a life hack, it's like a workaround, right? It's like a solution that's in a kludgy, broken system, right? So that's how I'm using it. Like if you have a hack, it's like a workaround. You've actually solved the problem in some like. You can't rebuild the system. You don't have the time, money, expertise, whatever. You got to have a workaround. So that's the hacker part. The teleology is like, if we connect these dots, we're going to get somewhere, whether we understand why or not, right? So kind of like we're talking about the system we have now, you connect financialization, globalization, pay to play. Hey, we end up with a corrupt, broken, fragile system. So if we want a different system, we're going to have to connect the dots in another way. And so to get to another destination, you know? So that's kind of the title. And for me, the dots we need to connect are, we need another kind of money, frankly. And like, this is where cryptocurrencies give us another way to do money. And part of my idea is, why don't we have a labor-backed cryptocurrency? Not one that's mined like Bitcoin that rich people buy, but a labor-backed cryptocurrency. In other words, when somebody does useful work in their community, then we create the cryptocurrency and pay them. And so it's labor-backed. And it's another way of creating money that's never been done before. But I think that would be part of our solution. So that's the kind of thing that I think about. How do we decentralize, bring capital and power back down to the community level? You know, and everybody talks about decentralization. And it's like, yeah, it's a nice idea. How do you do it?
You know, that's interesting. You mentioned the Bitcoin thing, or not Bitcoin, but the cryptocurrencies, because I've had a number of guests on that do not like Bitcoin. And I think a lot of us, especially on the progressive end of politics, are very wary of cryptocurrencies because Bitcoin seems like a very libertarian thing that could get out of control very quickly. But what you just said seems like a different take on it.
Yeah, absolutely. What I see is the potential for cryptocurrencies to actually serve, you know, labor and communities. And and you know, this idea is kind of old because say people often mention to me, well, in the Depression, then towns, you know, printed their own script, you know, that you could trade this kind of paper money just to help, you know, local commerce. But my idea is a little different than just printing, you know, local currency. It's the currency is created by, in only one way, labor that's been done to serve the community, that the community's decided, this is what's scarce in our community. This is what's necessary. This is what we need. So let's devote labor to it. And then let's pay people, you know? And if we think about the globe, the global economy, well, most work isn't paid. You know, somebody, some mother walking, you know, 2 kilometers to get water, she's not paid. There's no robot that's going to come in and go collect her water. Who's going to pay the robot? So, I mean, we need a system to start paying useful labor, as you say, purposeful, meaningful labor in service to the community, not like billionaires.
Now, with the cryptocurrency, my biggest concern with cryptocurrency is, for instance, with Bitcoin. You have all this Bitcoin mining in China, and it has a detrimental impact on the environment, as far as I can tell, or could be having that in the near term future. How would you get around that with cryptocurrencies?
Well, that's a great question, and I don't claim to be a crypto expert, but the thing is that's only one model of cryptocurrencies, that you can create a cryptocurrency, and it doesn't need to be mined and the you know, the enormous expense of having the Bitcoin blockchain, you know, on hundreds or thousands of computers. You don't need that. You could centralize a cryptocurrency and issue it. And there are a lot of other models out there, and there's a lot of work going on. So I think there could have a completely different low cost, centralized system of managing the cryptocurrency without all the mining, you know. There's a lot of models for crypto. Bitcoin's only one. Then there's Ethereum and Decred. I mean, you know, there's a lot of ferment out there. And I think there's going to be some really good ideas that are going to allow for a decentralized community-based crypto.
So before we close out, I guess what I want to ask you is, where do you see things headed? Do you see us moving in the direction of socialism light? At the behest of the Davos crowd, or do you see us moving towards this sort of sharing the wealth of our shrinking planet hacker's teleology? Where would you place your bets right now, I guess?
Well, I would place my bets on socialism light approved by the billionaires. But then what's going to happen is our system's fragile, you know, for the reasons Jim Reed laid out, and it's going to get more fragile, and then it's going to break. And it's going to probably break because the money will lose value so fast, you know, because they'll create too much of it. And when you get runaway inflation, then everybody's poorer and the system will break. And my idea is a sharing economy, a community-based economy, that's what happens after the system breaks. Then people will go, well, this system didn't work. You know, so what are we going to do next?
It sounds like socialism light would be, it's like a quick fix that puts off the bigger problem for maybe a decade.
I think that's absolutely right. That's right. It's a quick fix. And I would suspect it's more puts it off for no more than 4 or 5 years.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I think.
Well, why is that?
We're pretty far advanced in these problems that are leading to disorder. In other words, I think we're in the final inning here. It may feel like we're only in the third inning, but we're actually in the bottom of the ninth, that all the fragilities have been piling up like deadwood in a forest for 45 years. So I think we're a lot closer to disruption than most people anticipate. And that makes me a doom and gloomer, but I'm not a doom and gloomer. It's like fragile systems break, and then we got a chance for a reset.
So in closing here, I noticed that you said that you're more apt to call this the age of uncertainty. Why do you prefer the term the age of uncertainty over the age of disorder? And that may seem like a pedantic question, but I always find it interesting how we use language differently.
Well, thank you for that. Most people, you're a rare person to even recognize that uncertainty is an interesting word. I use that word because people make different decisions when certainty goes away. And so now that we're uncertain about the pandemic and the our economic future and the political system and all that stuff, people start making different decisions and they start planning their lives differently, you know? And so they're going to start thinking, well, if this something bad happens, what's my response going to be? And so, and people start responding by saying, I better save some money here, right? And maybe I better cut back on my expenses because of that uncertainty. And they start looking at reality differently. And I think more skeptically and more soberly. And I think that's a good thing.
So in closing, is there anything else you'd like to add or that you think my listeners should really be paying attention to? Because I feel like a lot of these things go under the radar. I was so happy to see you mention the Jim Reed report, because I don't see anyone else talking about it. I don't see anyone else talking about, you know, the World Economic Forum doing the Great Reset Summit. And I'm thinking to myself, why is no one talking about this? This seems like pretty important, because you have even the mega wealthy saying, oh, we may have to do some changes here. Not too big, but some type of change.
Yeah. I think my last comment would be the Davos crowd, and as you say, the reset they want is in more centralization. And if you read the documents and it's not just a conspiracy, it's the way everybody in government thinks. Let's centralize more power. That'll be the solution. I think we've reached the end of the road. We've reached peak centralized power, and we're going to need to decentralize. And the power structure that we have is not set up to decentralize. So therefore, it's much more likely to implode because it simply doesn't have the wherewithal or the means or the structure to decentralize power and capital.
The only thing I would add to that, and I just want to get your thought on this, and then I'll let you go, is, I think people often think of the mega wealthy as sort of monolithic in where they want to take things. I assume there's elements of Davos that are pro-social democratic. And then there's probably people like, I don't know, Sheldon Adelson back in the Trump administration, who may not be into the social democratic thing. Would I be correct in that assessment?
Yeah, I think so. And when we talk about the deep state, it's the same thing. There's a lot of fractures going on in the top of the leadership, you know, politically, socially, financially. Yeah. And those fractures are part of what people like Turchin say causes the system to break down and collapse, is the elites start fighting amongst themselves over what the future is. And, you know, so I think we see that.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on. We have to end it on an uncertain note for the age of uncertainty, right? So I want to give you a chance, though, to let my listeners know how they can follow your work and how they can purchase your new book, The Hacker's Teleology. And I would recommend anyone read it, to be honest. I would recommend libertarians read it. I would recommend people on the left, Marxists, read it. I think anyone can get something out of it.
Well, thank you very much. And just visit me at of2minds.com and you can download a big excerpt of the book. They'll give you a taste of my thinking and my life experience. And I just want to say, I thank you so much for such a brilliant run of questions that get to the heart of where we're at.
And thank you for coming on Parallax Views, Charles U. Smith.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Charles U. Smith. Please be sure to check out his blog, Of Two Minds. And if you can, pick up his book, The Hacker's Teleology, Sharing the Wealth of Our Shrinking Planet. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Amelia, Mark, Martin, Brace, John, Zach, Gratz, Ted, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producers credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, join those listeners at the $10 or $15 tiers on my Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. Also, note to my $15 subscribers, I will be doing a Zoom session this week, Friday, at around 8 p.m., I will be doing a Zoom session for $15 Patreon supporters. So if you'd like to join me, you should be receiving a message on Patreon soon about how to join that Zoom meeting. So again, patreon.com/parallaxviews. If you'd like to support me, you can even kick me a dollar, and if you kick me $5, well, you get the Parallax Views Current Events Program the week that was. That's at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.